Kansas City Royals down at Guaranteed Rate Field. Now, the Monday forecast from the National Weather Service, cloudy and mild. Rain showers off and on throughout the day, a high of 67. Just some light drizzle now, 63 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to begin the week by speaking with Jane Barbian, who has been a stalwart member of the school board for the Racine Unified School District and is serving right now as its president. And there are open seats and nominations being received, and it seemed like a good time for us to check in with Jane Barbian, not only about that specific matter, but also to just talk for a few minutes in general about some of the interesting challenges that are facing not only the Racine Unified School District, but public school districts, of course, all across the country. Jane Barbian, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
My wife, who has some acquaintance with you, being a retired Racine Unified School teacher, mentioned that you have some background yourself as an educator, as a teacher. Please give us just a little bit of background on kind of your professional path, which has ultimately led you to what you're doing right now on the school board.
Sure. I started as an early childhood teacher with four-year-olds. Back in, well, I won't tell you how long ago it was. And then I went into the elementary grades, grade 3, grade 2, spent a long time in grade 1. That was my absolute favorite. I love the emergent literacy of first graders. And then after about 20 years or so, I started to move into more teacher support type roles out of the district administrative office. I was a reading language arts coordinator, so I helped with all elementary teachers with their reading and language arts instruction. Did a lot of workshops in writing for teachers. Then I moved into educator effectiveness came on board, so I moved into that role, and then also as a teacher coach. And I ended my career, gosh, I'd say it was about 6-7 years ago, maybe, in that role. After retirement, I had weddings of two daughters, had some my knees replaced, and was looking for something else. Someone called me and said there was an opening for a school board member in my district. Would I consider it? I've long been a supporter of public schools in Racine. I was a graduate myself, sent my kids to public schools. My dad was a teacher at Gersted and at Case High School. My sister is a teacher right now at Case, so I have our family's been very invested in Racine Unified, so I thought, you know what, I can step up and see what I can do to make Racine Unified the school of choice for our community.
Fantastic. Explain exactly what the role of the school board is, and within that, what your responsibilities specifically are as its president.
Okay. The board has one role on the board. We have one employee, and that's the superintendent. Every communication we have, every action that we do is involving what the superintendent has put into place. If he puts into something that is, you know, a costly item and we have a certain cutoff for that, it has to go to the board and the board has to approve it as well. So we spend a lot of time approving operations type things with the district. Oh, this school needs a new furnace. This school needs, you know, to have the building painted, whatever. We spent a lot of time on that. And when I came on the board, I felt it was way too much time on operations and not enough time going over student achievement. Because to me, that should be the number one responsibility of the board, monitoring student achievement, making sure a district is moving the way that we want it to go. So that is, we have added many things to our board meetings that get more involved in student achievement. But just monitoring the superintendent, monitoring what he's doing to make sure the strategic plan is moving forward, which always includes an academic achievement piece. Now, of course, it's big because we had the referendum finally go through, and we have all of these facility changes happening for building of schools, remodeling of schools, things like that. That's huge. And the other thing is, of course, since our one employee is the superintendent, right now we do not have a head superintendent. We are in the process of searching and interviewing and selecting the next superintendent to guide the district. So that's pretty much it.
So just to be clear, you are entrusted, I don't mean you individually, but you as a board are entrusted with the responsibility of searching for and selecting whoever will be the next superintendent for the school district.
Absolutely. We are looking for a search firm that can do national, international searches for us to find the best possible candidate. But then the board will be going through those possible candidates to select the ones that we would like to have interview for a possible placement in our schools.
In the meantime, of course, there is an interim superintendent of the school district. You'll have to remind me of the name. But
Soren Gajewski.
Yes.
And he was the, chief of instruction, something like that, his title was. So he just kind of moved in to cover the role of the interim superintendent, and he's doing a fabulous job, wonderful job. He's really holding through, keeping all of the existing programs in place and moving us through in the time while we are searching for this new superintendent. So thank you very much, Soren. I appreciate everything you're doing.
And I assume that at least in most respects, you as a board are functioning in very much the same way you did and will when there is a permanent superintendent in place. I mean, you aren't entrusted with additional responsibilities simply because there is only an interim superintendent in place.
No. The only difference might be that we're a little bit more scrutinizing everything that's done. We want to make sure everything is going as we want it to. Everything is progressing well. So we might be just kind of having a little bit more scrutiny than what we used to. Soren Gajewski might be asking for a little bit more guidance from the board right now, especially me as the board president. But otherwise, everything's moving along very smoothly. It's been a good start to the school year, which, as you know, is one of the busiest times of our year.
Of course. So explain to our listeners about the whole matter of school board elections and where we are in the timeline for the next set of elections.
Well, I have to say that when I became an elected official myself, when I became a school board member, it gave me a huge appreciation for all of our elected officials. Running for an office, whether it be a school board seat or, you know, governor of Wisconsin, it's not an easy process, and I want to make it as simple as I can for people who are interested. District 6 and District 8 are the two vacancies. District 6 is downtown. District 8 is the North Bay, Wind Point, part of Caledonia area. Two very important districts that represent the diversity of our city. They both became vacant because the school board members had to move out of their district. I don't know if you're aware, but Racine Unified is one of the few districts in Wisconsin that has the actual school district boundary broken up into separate districts. Like, for example, mine is District 9, and I'm way out here in Caledonia. The rest of the school districts, it's just, and this is how Racine used to be, that if you were interested in school board, it didn't matter where you lived. You could just run for the school board as long as you lived somewhere in the Racine unified boundary. But now you have to actually live in a smaller district area and represent that district and be elected by the people who live in that district.
So any other stipulations in terms of who is qualified to run for these two vacant positions on the school board?
Yes, I have a couple of things. Two musts. You have to reside in the district that you are posting for. So if you want to run for District 6, you must live in that downtown area. If you want to run for District 8, you have to live in that district, and they will check the boundaries to make sure. A couple that I would like to add is you have to be eligible to vote in that district. Even if you haven't voted in the past, you are eligible to register to vote. You are eligible to vote in your district. Those are definite musts. You can't be on the board if you don't have those. I'd like to add just a couple, if you allow me.
Sure.
You have to make the commitment to attend meetings. And I know a lot of people say, well, it's just one meeting a month, I could do that. It really isn't. And I want to make that as clear as I can. Yes, we have one business meeting a month. That's absolutely accurate. Usually goes about 3-4 hours. But before that meeting, all of the prep work has to be done. You have to go into this this program that we have on our computers. We have to look at all the documents, all of the things that are going to be approved in that meeting, and I have to know it well, and I have to ask the questions and have my questions prepared. That actually takes me another 2 to 3 hours every time we have a meeting. We also have another meeting every month, which is called our work session. That's when we get a chance to go over the things in the agenda and ask those questions, advise and make changes, anything that we are curious about or that we feel is on there incorrectly. That's when we bring that up. That's another 3 or 4 hours a week. In addition to that, all board members serve on board committees, whether it's the governance committee, the legislative committee. We have representatives that attend the state school board association meetings. We have people that attend our rep for Park and Rec or attend for city council. Whatever it is, all of the board members have those responsibilities as well. In addition, now we're adding extra meetings because we're talking about the superintendent searches. We're adding extra meetings because we have to do these school board vacancy seats and do interviews for those. So even though it sounds like it's one, you know, one meeting a month, it really isn't. It's quite, and that was a big shock for me as well. It's a lot of time. I think my husband was very surprised as well how much time is actually spent on board business. Another thing I'd really like to add, and this was something I heard said, and I really think it's true. If you are interested in running for District 6 or District 8, please be an advocate for public schools. Please be an advocate for our school district. We need all the positive energy coming in when you serve on the board. That's a big one for me. Mm. So that's pretty much the must of what I think if anyone is considering becoming a board member, to make sure you are committed to the time and then that you have a very positive attitude for the public schools.
So what exactly is the deadline for people to file to be nominees for these vacancies?
Yes, it's due September 13th at 5 o'clock. It's due to the administrative building on 3109 Mount Pleasant Street in Racine. It's right over by Horlick High School. And it's due to Elizabeth Tobias. And you need to include a letter of interest, which means it has your name, your address, your email, your phone number, and the reasons why you want to serve on the board. And that's an important thing because that's what the board members will be looking at as they go through these to see who would be a good candidate for the school board, those reasons why you want to be on the board. And then there's a campaign registration form, which is on the website, and also your resume. You need to include those three things, letter of interest, the resume, and the campaign registration form. And they're all available on the district website. If you click on the district website and you go to the Board of Education, then you'll see a link to education info, and it's all there, including the map of the different districts. You can actually click and say, oh, am I in District 6 or am I in District 9? No,
great,
8.
Great idea.
Yeah, you can click on that map to actually find where your home is and see what district it lines in. And I encourage everybody to do that, to click on those maps to see where your home is and which board member represents your district. And if we have time, I'd just like to add a couple of things.
Sure.
The positives about being on the board, because I talked about a lot of things, but there's so many positives. We have a great board right now. The board gets along very well. Some of the school boards in our area are really struggling because they have such different voices. But our board really operates smoothly. And that's a lot because we have board policy that guides our actions. So even though I'm an advocate for student achievement and doing everything we can to improve our student achievement, other board members come in with other interests that they have. But because of board policy, you need to make sure it falls into, how can I explain this? If you're, say, you're a big advocate for every fifth grader being taught how to use a checkbook, for example, I don't know why you would want that, but in case you did, you cannot go in with your own personal agenda. Board policy is going to guide how you can certainly bring that up or bring it to the board's attention, but you can't actually, use your own personal interest during board meetings because board policy guides all of that. And that is actually a helpful thing because it eliminates a lot of dissension on the board. It really keeps the board moving in the direction that benefits our students. I hope people consider being on the board. They want to benefit our children, benefit our community. As they say, the community is only as strong as its public schools. You want to make our community a better place. You want to support the facility plan that's in place. It's a huge responsibility for the board. Believe me, I've learned more about large construction projects than I ever thought I would have to. You want to help be a part of picking our new superintendent. And you're an advocate for public education, not just talking to your neighbors and friends in your community, but also with legislators and other elected officials. Be an advocate for public schools. There are some negatives. It's a huge commitment, as I talked about. You have to be following board policy, and every time I meet a new board member, I always tell him or her, get to know board policy as quickly as you can because it really guides your actions. There's a lot of constituent phone calls, especially at this time of year when school starts. You get a lot of calls about busing issues, and you have to be open for that. You have to have your phone accessible, and you have to be able to return phone calls from people that are questioning things about the school district. You can't really share things about board business. You can't share it on social media. You can't really talk to family or friends. I rarely talk to my own husband about board things. I'm pretty confidential. Board business stays at the board. It's board business. And, of course, being available. Being available 24/7, really, to handle board business as it comes up. So that's a lot of the positives and a lot of the negatives, but I do want to encourage anyone who is a huge advocate of public schools to please consider it. I think it's you really have a sense of satisfaction for serving your community, serving for the betterment of the children in your district and trying to make Racine the best possible place we can make, because it's a great place to live. We all know that. And let's just get that public and make people know what a great place this is, yeah. Not only to send their kids to school, but just to live.
Very good. I just want to take a minute or so to just touch briefly on something that's going on in the school district, namely that a number of elementary schools are being transitioned into K-8 schools, including, for instance, yes. The school where my wife Kathy taught for more than 30 years, Schulte School out in Sturtevant. It's not the only one that is being transitioned into a K-8 school. Can you just briefly explain the reasoning behind this change?
Oh, that's very easy, because I was a big advocate for that. We really responded to parent requests. Parents really like the idea of K-8s, and we learned that when we added the middle school to Gifford out here. Parents are uncomfortable sending sixth graders to those big middle schools that we had in the past. And I felt very strongly that they like K-8s. They like keeping their child into that school with familiar location, familiar teachers, until they are ready for high school. There's some research that's been done that shows K-8s better prepare students for high school, which was a concern for me because I wasn't sure if they would be able to adjust to a high school well, but they were. There's research behind that. We not only are adding the K-8 to Schulte, which already has sixth grade at Schulte this year, very exciting. We're going to be adding the seventh and eighth grade in time for next year. But Jersey's, of course, is K-8. And Olympia Brown is going to go K-8. So there's a lot of excitement with that. And some of the people who live in those areas who may be hesitant about sending their child to one of the larger middle schools can feel reassured now that they're going to be able to stay right at that school and benefit from staying and having the same teacher, same location. Fine arts, as you know, is K-8.
Right.
So there's a lot of good pluses for that. One of the things that I supported with the referendum when it came through is I wanted our middle schools to be smaller. I did not like those large middle schools. Mm. Too many kids. You know, it's a very difficult age to work with. They're adult-sized bodies, but they're still children at heart. So I said, I support this because we were going to bring our middle schools down to about 500 kids.
Mm.
And that's what I was looking for.
More of a community. More of a community.
Right. Yeah. So that is why. And then I talked to Dr. Gallion when he was superintendent that from what I heard out in the community and from my constituents is that they are supportive of K-8 schools. And I have to say K, which includes, of course, 4K.
Mm.
So as we build these new schools, these new additions now, we're making sure we have room for 4K as well.
Very
so
good.
It's a wonderful option.
I appreciate the explanation. Also, real quick, as someone who cares a lot about music and the arts in general, can you just say a quick word about the place of art and music and theater and so on in this world that is increasingly dominated by talk of STEM? Do you see that as still an important part of what happens in a place like Racine Unified?
To me, the arts fit into STEM. I have said over and over, as you know, my father was a music teacher, so I have a strong music background myself. I could not have learned fractions if it wasn't for music, because reading music, this is 3/4 time, this is 6/8 time, really gave me that concrete understanding. And there's tons of research out there about how the arts support literacy, whether it's reading or math. And not only that, but at our high school level, and I've been talking to the superintendent quite a bit about this, we're getting to have fewer and fewer electives for our high school kids. And unfortunately, that limits their ability to take the art and the music and the drama. It's so important because there's so many kids that struggle with math, they struggle with reading, they struggle in science. But as when they go to school, that one art class or that drama class or that music class that's what gets them motivated to come to school every day.
That's where they taste some success.
Where they that's meet. Where they're successful. That's, as my daughter, who was an IB student at Case, used to say, Mom, that's the one time when I'm in choir that I can just relax and it's stress-free and I can enjoy myself. And it's so true. And the arts are so important. And I keep talking to the superintendent about how at our middle school level and at our high school level, we have to make sure that our kids have that time for those the arts, because they're critical, I think, in our school. And if we start to lose them at the middle school level, we'll never get them at the high school level. And, you know, maybe it's not the career choice that some kids are going to make. Not everyone's going to become, you know, a talented musician and make a living at it, but it certainly is something that they can do during their time, be a partner of the Theater Guild or be a partner of the Racine Symphony or whatever it is. It just adds enjoyment to your life.
Absolutely. Jane Barbian, president of the Racine Unified School District School Board, and we want to remind everyone again of the deadline for applications for nominees for the vacancies on the school board. Those are due 5 p.m. on September 13th, and you can go to the Racine Unified School District's website, which is excellent, very nicely laid out, to get more information. Jane Barbian, the very busy president of the school board, I appreciate you taking time for this conversation today. Thank you so much. Best wishes to you and your colleagues.
Yes, same to you. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out today's program, we're going to be remembering the events that occurred on this date 22 years ago, 9/11. We'll be listening to an excerpt of an interview I was privileged to record with Jim Dwyer, a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and columnist with the New York Times, and co-author with Kevin Flynn of what I regard to be the single most remarkable book about 9/11, titled 102 Minutes, The Untold Story of the Fight to Survive Inside the Twin Towers, a carefully crafted chronicle of survivor stories, the stories of the thousands of people who were inside the Twin Towers on that terrible morning, who somehow managed to escape the towers with their lives. Many of these stories are incredibly compelling and inspiring.
Whose idea was it to focus on 9/11 as you and Kevin Flynn have in this book, 102 Minutes? Was this your realization that this story had yet to be told?
Yeah, we had a very powerful sense, you know, in the months after 9/11 is that, you know, that there were aspects to this event that we really didn't understand at all. You know, a lot of that had to do with its magnitude and, you know, and the circumstances. And there were so many elements to the thing. The country was going to war. We were trying to dig people. New York City was trying to dig people out of the rubble of the Trade Center. And we weren't even sure how many people had died there for quite a while. The city at one point was making estimates of 10,000 and 5,000. And the number turned out to be extremely horrific, but it turned out to be 2,749. So what we began to think about was, you know, how did people survive and who survived and why and what was going on inside that building? I had read some years back, I'm kind of a sucker for these original historical documents, and a book had come out around the time of the movie Titanic, and it was the transcripts of the hearings into the Titanic disaster. And what had happened was when the Titanic landed in New York, when the Carpathia landed in New York with the survivors from the Titanic, and that was, you know, April, over 100 years ago, the Senate Commerce Committee began hearings the very next morning with those survivors and the crew and the management of the Titanic's ownership and so forth. And that went on for 18 days. They literally met these people at the dock and said, tomorrow morning, come to the Waldorf Astoria. We're going to begin these hearings. And out of that emerged this immediate, powerful record that essentially shaped all of our understanding about the Titanic. That's how we found out, you know, the story of Isidore and Ida Strauss, you know, the famous couple who, they were the owners of Macy's department store here in New York, and they had, you know, Mrs. Strauss was in, and her maid were getting settled in the lifeboat, and it turned out that it was women and children first, and so Mr. Strauss was staying behind, and so she got out and went, stayed with him, and, you know, so you and it became a part of the, you know, the mythic history of the day, and it happened to be factual. And you, that's also where you found out that the ship had gone, you know, had set sail with only half the number of lifeboats for the passengers on board. So even if there had been, you know, a very well-organized evacuation, which there had not been, they couldn't have fit everybody into the lifeboats they had. And then, you know, the issues of communication and coordination among the rescue ships that were at sea that morning, and you know, why some responded and why some didn't. So all of that had very powerful resonance as time went on with us in our reporting on the Trade Center and on the Twin Towers. And I began, and my colleagues, Kevin Flynn and some, a group of other reporters here at the time, you know, we were putting together as much original accounting of what had gone on that day. And there were two basic sources for that. One was that the New York City started an oral history project with the fire department, and that didn't start for at least a month after the after 9/11. And those oral histories, for the most part, remain secret. We have been able to, through unofficial channels, get about 100 of them, and we're still litigating even to this day over the remaining 400. But the other source that was very immediate and powerful were the telephone calls, the cell phone messages that people got out, the emails that they were able to send out, mostly from their handheld BlackBerries, and also radio transmissions from inside the building. The buildings were owned, the whole complex was owned by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and they had a taping system for their internal communications, for both their walkie-talkies and for phone calls to their, they had their own little police force there. So we went to court and were able to obtain virtually all of those transcripts of all of those tapes, and that was about 2,000 pages. So we began to assemble a picture from inside the building, and of course there were survivors to interview, and on the day of the attacks, we, as I mentioned, had, you know, hundreds of people, you know, at or near Ground Zero, and interviewing people all throughout the region as well who had escaped and gotten home. And so we had this huge, huge factual record. We didn't have the same kind of organized questioning and answers that had gone on with the Titanic, but we had, in its own way, a very, very rich and powerful body of documentary contemporary information. And it was from that we began to assemble the first some newspaper stories. One was called 102 Minutes, and then a second story about difficulties with the emergency rescue response.
Hmm. We should probably mention, I don't think we've said so yet, that 102 minutes refers to the time elapsed between the first plane impact and the second of the two tower collapses. That was, in effect, the span of time of, in effect, I suppose, the immediate crisis. And your book takes us painstakingly through those 102 minutes with far greater detail than I think most of us would have ever imagined would be possible.
Well, that's a result, as I said, of this rich body of information. Now, I should say that, you know, these messages, these tape transmissions, the phone calls and so forth were coming from, you know, obviously we all know the towers were enormous structures. They were each 110 stories. And so you had people at each of those floors was an acre. So essentially, you had 220 acres, and people on the 12th floor didn't really know what was going on the 13th floor. In fact, they might not even know what was going on the other side of the 12th floor. So in piecing together the stories, and piecing together the information, there was no one to say, well, here's what was going on in the top 20 floors. There was no one single source you could go to. You had to assemble it from all these little fragments. And in doing so, you know, we came across, a number of large facts, large truths about the day, and then smaller truths about the day that had their own power. Let me give you an example of the large truth. The large truth would be that pretty much everyone above the impact zones in both buildings died. Certainly everyone above the impact zone, at or above the impact zone in the North Tower, died. In the South Tower, that's true for all but 18 people, and those 18 people managed to find an intact staircase. Below the impact zone, upwards of 99% or so of the people were able to escape. You know, that's a very important set of facts to me. You know, how did they escape? Why did they escape? They escaped because the stairs were well lit, because there were stripes on the stairs that glowed in the dark, and they escaped because they made sure they escaped. In other words, they took care to people who were working their way down the stairs stayed calmly in line. Nobody cut ahead. When somebody was burnt from the high floor, somebody who had gotten blasted by the fireball as it moved through the elevator shaft, when a person like that was coming down the stairs, everybody pulled aside and made room to let them go by. When people passed individuals who were in wheelchairs, some of the younger, stronger folks would pick those people up and carry them down. There's a mailroom worker at Morgan Stanley who worked around the 60th floor, and one of his colleagues, he didn't know the woman, but as he was walking down the stairs, he was struggling down on canes, and she was disabled. And, of course, no elevators. How else is she going to get down? He and some other people were trying to carry her, but they were having a terrible time, and he just ended up putting her over his shoulder and carrying her down 50 floors. And neither of those two people knew each other, and it was only through putting together, we had two sets of notes, one from the woman describing the event, describing being picked up, and one was a phone call that had come in a week later, from a little girl who said she just wanted people to know about her dad, because he had ended up in the hospital after this tremendous feat of carrying somebody down 50 flights of stairs. And she called and she described her daddy was coming down the stairs, and he saw this lady who couldn't walk, and he picked her up, and he carried her out to the ambulance and so forth, and he had hurt his back or something like that, and he ended up in the hospital, but he was fine. But we eventually figured out, they both happened to work at the same company, and we were able to put that together. So that was one of the important things. Now, the people above the impact zone who did not get out had a different set of circumstances. First of all, in both towers, obviously, there were people who were killed immediately by the impact of the plane. But also in both towers, an enormous number of people survived the impacts, even some of them on the very floors where the planes had hit. And those folks could not get out of the building. Why couldn't they get out? Well, it turns out that when the Trade Center was being built, there were three... When the Trade Center was being built and designed back in the 1960s, New York City and most of the rest of the country and big cities were changing their building codes for very tall buildings. They wanted to take advantage of new technologies, and they wanted to increase the profitability of the tall skyscrapers. And one of the ways they did that was saying, well, let's increase the amount of rentable space. Now, how do you do that? Well, in cities, the reason you build skyscrapers is because you can't spread out. You can only go up. So there's a very limited amount of a footprint, you might say, for the building to rise from. So what New York did and what other cities did was decrease the amount of space that was required for things like staircases. You take a building like the Empire State Building, which went up during the Depression, that has six staircases in the middle of the building, you know, say, and you know, from through most of the building up to the top, it has six staircases. And at the bottom, it actually has nine staircases that kind of flares out. And one of those six staircases that runs from the top of the building to the bottom is called the fire tower, and it actually has reinforced brick walls around it, concrete brick walls around it, and there's an airlock that naturally sucks smoke out so that when you go into the staircase, the smoke doesn't travel with you. So you have a pretty much a safe passage out of the building in a fire. The building code adopted in New York during the 1960s, as the Trade Center was being designed, removed that fire tower, and it also reduced by half the number of required staircases. So you went from six staircases to three.
Yeah, I remember you also mentioning that in that 1968 revamping of the codes, there is language there which just relaxes a bit something which also proved to be crucial, and that is how far apart from each other exits or stairways should be in these buildings.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, this does not make for very gripping drama, but it turned out to be very significant in people's ability to survive. What they call the remoteness of the stairs was, there have been some requirements in some of the earlier codes for certain kinds of buildings that the stairs be spread out, be as remote as possible from each other. And that was relaxed somewhat in the code. And the result was in the Trade Center, you had three staircases, not six, clustered more or less in the middle of the building. So this, you had essentially, you know, they were all knocked out immediately. One of the reasons we know that, you know, having them spread out more would have been important is that in the South Tower, which was the second of the two buildings to be hit, the staircases, I said before, ran down the middle of the building, ran right down the core of the building. But in the South Tower, and actually in the North Tower as well, when they came to certain floors where there was big elevator machines, the stairs diverted from the core of the building. They kind of fanned out briefly to the perimeter and then came back into the core once they had gotten past these elevator machines. In the South Tower, where the plane hit was on one of these floors where the stairs had fanned out. And so that left one intact staircase, at least for part of the time, and 18 people were able to escape through that. But now, when you get, so that's sort of the large picture stuff that we were, you know, finding as we pieced together these smaller things. And, you know, we didn't do it, you know, it was not strictly our own insights or anything like that. I mean, there was a terrific journalism done in the USA Today by a reporter named Dennis Kashan on this front, and also Martha Moore, also writing in the USA Today. And a lot of good journalism in Wall Street Journal and New York Daily News and other papers. And surely we had the ability, the advantage of integrating that into our larger narrative as we went forward. So we really leaned on a lot of smart people in doing this. We also picked up stories about individuals who were making a tremendous difference. I mentioned the impact zone being kind of a borderline between those who survived and those who didn't. Give me a story of a man named Frank DeMartini and a colleague of his named Pablo Ortiz, who worked on the 88th floor in the North Tower. Frank and Pablo were employees of the Port Authority, as it happened. And when the plane hit their building at 8:46 that morning, it was several floors above them. But the damage was considerable on their floor. The ceilings were dropping down. There was walls that were knocked out of place. There was an enormous amount of rubble on the ground. Some people who had been by the elevator shaft were burned by the fuel ball, the ball of fire that ran up and down the building in the elevator shaft. And So it was very hard to get off of their floor. But Frank DeMartini and Pablo Ortiz and a few other men, a man named Matt Canna and some others, kind of climbed through all this rubble and cleared out a path and were able to lead. You know, there were sick people there. There was people with asthma who were immediately having a hard time, of course, with the smoke and the fumes. They were able to lead this group out to the staircase. But one floor above them, the situation was not as promising. They didn't have a DeMartini and Ortiz there. Moreover, they had a separate and very, very serious problem that doomed a lot of people that day. And on the 89th floor, one floor above, you had Metropolitan Life Insurance, some law firms and other companies, and those people found when they went out into their hallway that the elevator shaft was completely blown apart. It was just a big black hole with smoke and fire coming out of it. Somebody tried to squirt a fire extinguisher into it, and they realized it was hopeless. The doorways into the stairs were jammed. The twist and knock of the building when the plane had hit it had knocked many, many doors out of alignment. And so you had these metal doors and metal frames that couldn't open. They were just stuck tight. And literally, the floor under their feet began to melt. And these folks, you know, some of them were pounding on the door, but some of them just said, okay, that's it. I'm going inside. I'm going to call home. And they started making calls to loved ones to say farewell. I'm not going to be home. And just as some of them are making these phone calls and some of them are still standing in the hallway by the door, a voice comes hollering at them from the stairway and says, "Get away from the door." And into this smoking, melting floor, a crowbar smashes through the sheetrock and pries open the door. And standing there are these three guys covered in dust and soot, Frank DeMartini, Pablo Ortiz, Matt Canna. And they go in, they clear the floor, they get all these people who are saying farewell to their loved one, they get them moving into the staircase and get them on their way down. And then they moved around, by the way. They went up to the 90th floor.
I was going to say, they moved on to more. You say it was hardly the job of Frank DeMartini and Pablo Ortiz and the others from 88 to go around prying open doors. Their responsibilities at the Trade Center during an emergency, I suppose officially, were to get themselves out of the building. You go on to say the sprinklers, the fireproofing, the smoke venting systems were all supposed to kick in automatically. This network of emergency systems succumbed one by one on September 11th, replaced by a lethal web of obstacles. Only when people like DeMartini and his crew took it upon themselves to attack those barriers, broken rubble, stuck doors, disorientation, could people go free.
That's right. Frank and Pablo, as we piece together the story, Frank had a walkie-talkie, and so we were able to pick up a few of his communications, and we were able to trace other people's radio transmissions and find witnesses to, you know, as they moved around, they helped get people off of the 90th floor. They went down, so they had done the 88th floor, the 89th floor, 90th floor. They went down to 86. They got a group out of there. We were able to verify that they got some people around the 83rd and 84th floors. They went down also to the 78th floor and pried open an elevator door and got a man out of there. And, you know, by piecing together little transmissions from a security guard here and DeMartini there, we were able to figure out what these men had been doing during those 102 minutes.
Mm. Let me jump in for a moment because I think we've not yet made what is, I think, a very central point. You mention it actually in the epilogue of the book when you say that in the first official telling of the story of the Trade Center rescue, civilians played little role except as helpless victims who were saved by the police and firefighters. And you say this was an incomplete history, though not uncommonly so. But that is one of the points of the way that you have written this book, is to help us understand the courage and tenacity and imagination of civilians within the trade towers who played such an important role in getting as many people out as were able to get out.
What they did was extraordinary, and it was unheralded.
Jim Dwyer, co-author with Kevin Flynn of 102 Minutes, The Untold Story of the Fight to Survive Inside the Twin Towers, a Times book. Jim Dwyer passed away in 2020. If you're interested in hearing this interview in its entirety, seek out the podcast version of the program. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.